Registration is now open for Meet Me at the Margin, a month-long virtual conference for queer people who want to reclaim and restore their innate capacity for ambiguity, paradox, and liminality. Through a series of eight workshops facilitated by some of today's most marginal thinkers, participants will explore queerness through the lenses of tarot, astrology, narrative therapy, eco-mythology, archetype art, and more. Facilitators include Charlie Claire Burgess, Amy DeGennaro, Edgar Fabian Frias, Nick Kepley, Jonathan Coe, Elias Lallier, Sophie Strand, Jason Perez, and Chanti Tankaranto Perez. The conference kicks off June 4th with sessions held every Sunday and Wednesday evening through June 18th. Discounted rates are available for students ages 18 to 22, as well as for members of the trans and drag communities. Visit manofthecards.com/meetmeatthemargin to register, and we'll see you at the margin next month. Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Welcome back, everyone. I am recording this intro today on my back porch, and the birds are really sending out the energy at dusk. So you may hear some background noise, but I'm trusting that that'll just kind of add to the ambiance of today's episode. So hopefully you don't mind, and hopefully you can hear everything I'm saying. Today we are releasing our third guest host episode. And this one features friend of the pod, Charlie Claire Burgess of The Word Witch, interviewing their friend, Stephanie Adams Santos of Tarot_Obscuro on Instagram. And to me, this conversation feels like a cozy night around the fire with two BFFs chatting and snuggled up under a blanket, maybe watching the fireflies dance outside of their window. It's lovely. It's incredible. It's such a cozy listen, and you can really feel the love between these two friends. And it just feels really special to share both of these incredible people's thoughts and conversation with all of you. And I'm really grateful to Charlie for guest hosting this episode. Charlie has meant so much to me over the years in so many different ways and has always been so incredibly supportive. And I just am really appreciative of them. And I am also excited to announce that Charlie is going to be one of the guest facilitators for the Meet Me at the Margin conference. And they have titled their workshop, Tarot for Non-Binary Thinking. So let me just read their amazing description of what their workshop is going to entail. So Charlie writes, most people think of tarot as a fortune-telling device, but when we explore this evocative pack of cards from a queer vantage, we discover that the tarot is also an essentially queer-aligned tool for non-binary thinking. Using the cards, we can interpret colonial, cis-heteronormative binary models of thinking that divide existence into male-female, good-bad, human nature, mind-body, perfection-failure, us, them, and instead cultivate non-binary ways of thinking and feeling that embrace strangeness, curiosity, liminality, complexity, flexibility, and change. In this class, we will reframe the tarot's major arcana as a journey from binary thinking to non-binary thinking, and explore methods and frameworks for using the cards in this queer and liberatory way. Hello. Who doesn't want to be there for that? If you're listening to this podcast, I know you want to be there for that. And I just want to say that the entire conference, the Meet Me at the Margin conference, does kick off on June 4th. It's coming up. And discounts are available for members of the trans and drag communities, as well as for students ages 18 to 22 and members of the In Search of Tarot Patreon. So if you are a regular listener of this podcast, and if you have thought ever to yourself, you know, maybe I should support this podcast, or maybe it would be nice to financially kind of give back to this podcast that I enjoy so much, now is the time, because you can save 15% on the cost of the Meet Me at the Margin conference by joining our Patreon today for as little as $2 a month. And speaking of which, Angie and I are actually going to be hosting our Patreon Tarot Hang for May this coming Tuesday, May 30th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern. And if you're new to Tarot Hangs, these are monthly informal opportunities to meet other tarot lovers and chat about life using the cards as references and guides. There's no agenda or requirement for these hangs. You just show up with your favorite deck and an open mind. And I really cannot say enough about these. Over the past, I guess we've been doing them over a year now, they just have really become an amazing high point of my month. You know, it's always a different group of people that join, and the conversations we have are just really rich. They've kind of evolved over the months. You know, when I first started them, I used to feel this pressure to like have an agenda and really have certain things that I wanted to discuss. But now I just show up and I always feel a little bit of nerves, like before I hit go on the Zoom, like, I don't know what I'm going to talk about tonight. And then we just go, and like the amazing thoughts and insights that everybody brings and the way that we kind of feed off each other's energy every month is just really inspiring and incredible. So if that sounds exciting to you, it's as low as $2 a month to be part of our Patreon. And like I said, you can really save on this conference if that also interests you. So you can find out more about all of these goodies over on my website, which is still manofthecards.com. I've still not converted that website because it will be a major process that I just don't quite have time for right now. So bear with me with that incongruence. But I'm also going to leave these links for you in the show notes of this episode. And I really hope you'll join us for all of these things. Okay, let me introduce you now to Charlie and Stephanie by way of their bios. Charlie Claire Burgess is a queer and trans non-binary tarot reader, deck creator, writer, and artist. They are the creator of Fifth Spirit Tarot, a queer and inclusive deck for a world beyond binaries, and the author of Radical Tarot, a guide to reading tarot radically for personal and collective liberation. Charlie is currently at work on a second tarot deck, the Gay Marseille Tarot, and a book on queer devotion. They teach classes on tarot and queer magical topics online and in Portland, Oregon, and sometimes they record episodes for their podcast, The Word Witch. You can find Charlie on their website, thewordwitchtarot.com, and also on Instagram at the.word.witch. All right, sorry everyone. If you heard that strange sound towards the end of Charlie's bio, there's some construction going on outside my house, and I have moved inside now. So hopefully you can hear better. And let me now share Stephanie's bio with you. The work of Stephanie Adams Santos spans poetry, prose, screenwriting, and visual art. She, they are the author of the full-length poetry collections Dreams of Zibalba and Swarm Queen's Crown, a Lambda Literary Award finalist. Their chapbooks include Total Memory and The Sundering, New York Chapbook Fellowship, Poetry Society of America. Stephanie's short story, Nightflowers, appeared in the Latinx anthology Speculative Fiction for Dreamers. Stephanie was a staff writer and story editor on the television anthology horror series Two Sentence Horror Stories, CW Netflix. Their episode Elliot won a 2022 Gold Telly Award in writing. As an inaugural fellow of the 2022 Ohala Ignition Fellowship, they developed an original fantasy pilot based on the world and characters of the tarot. In addition to her literary work, Adams Santos is a professional tarot reader and is making headway on an original major arcana tarot deck inspired by occult animism. In all her work, she is drawn to queerness, the uncanny, and whatever draws us closer to the primal source. You can find Stephanie at obscurobeach.com and on Instagram at tarot_obscuro.
Stephanie, thank you so much for being here with me. I guess I want to start by, like, I guess telling people how we know each other.
Yes.
That feels like a good spot. So I know you through our mutual friend, Coleman Stevenson of The Dark Exact. And like, I don't know, you and I have had the opportunity to like chat in her presence and connect a few times that way. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time that we've gotten to like sit down solo and talk about all the things.
Go into all the depths.
Yes.
So very exciting. Yes.
So I think that let's get started. We've got so many topics to talk about, but since we're on a podcast about tarot, let's start there. I would really love to hear from you about, of course, the tarot deck that you are in the process of creating, which is just incredible, and like the art of it, it feels actually a lot like your poetry does.
Oh wow, thank you.
In that it's like, it's got this like visceral, like almost like mystical something happening there. It feels like urgent to me.
Something under there.
Yes. So can you talk about that a little bit, like where that started? I know you've been reading tarot for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I love that you connected it to my poetry too, because it feels very similar in the creation process. You know, this idea of kind of opening all the channels and letting things rise. And letting images rise. And I am not someone who knows what I'm writing ever. It's almost like dream state, like this blindness takes over. And I let that happen with this deck. Like I'd really wanted to create a deck, and I was trying for a long time to approach it really thoughtfully, but I'm a really poor thinker. I'm very undisciplined mind. And I didn't feel like the thought angle was working for me, and I just one night let this image arise, and the centipede from the Temperance card came up. That was the first card I created, and it was bright red, a color I never associate with Temperance, and a centipede covered in eyes. And that just announced itself. It was like, hello, I'm Temperance, you know, and that felt really, because I felt like I was learning from the symbols, you know, like, oh, I'm now following something primal that I don't mentally know, and that felt like the right way.
Yeah.
And that's the same with the poetry, is it's like following a thread that's not quite yours.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh man, one of the cards that I wanted to ask you about was Temperance, because it's one of the ones that fascinates me the most in your deck. Because it is so surprising, like a centipede covered in eyes,
a strangeling. Yeah.
And
a Temperance is one of those cards for me that, like, when I was first learning tarot and getting to know it, you know how there are some cards you just don't form a relationship. It's like I was drawn to the devil and to, you know, death and all the extreme cards, and then Temperance felt like this tame card that lacked mystery, which is so ironic because it's one of the most mysterious to me now, and I associate it so much with like the alchemist of the deck. I think in the past I used to think of the magician as like the alchemist of the deck, because you actually see the, like, you know, in like the Rider-Waite, you see the table and the objects, but now it's Temperance for me. Like, this, there's so much invisible happening, and like the fluidity that's happening there, and the inner alchemy, and also the fluidity and like the queerness of it, the otherness of it.
Yes.
It's now one of my favorite and most, it's one of the most mysterious and potent cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's that name. It's like the word Temperance that gives us this false idea.
Like, oh, moderation.
Exactly.
Like, and we're both maximalists, so it's like, no.
Precisely. I've never been good at tempering anything in my life. But like, even with the concept of Temperance, the background of that word, the places that it's been and what it has meant are much different, and I think more mysterious and more like non-binary, like not just like this like middle path idea, but this almost like entanglement of like all
interweavings,
of extremes and just.
Well, that was something, because so when I was when the centipede came up as temperance, and it was red, and I thought like, well, where's the water? Because I associate water with temperance and that fluidity, but my thought was the water's in, like, look at the shape of the centipede and the way its body moves, you know, it's the water is fully integrated. And I thought of the blood red, you know, and the water, like the ocean within, and just it started, like, all these thoughts started coming up about, you know, some of the ways we can take these like archetypes of the cards and really live them and start to see them transmute into other forms. And that really excited me. And that's when, that's also when I was like, oh, this is an animus deck.
Yeah.
It's looking for these things outside of our human realms.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. So, and that's a question that, I had written down a topic to bring up with you actually is animism, because I have, seen that word in connection with, I believe, your poetry as well, as well as the word mystic and mystical. I think that in, I think that it was actually in relation to Swarm Queen's Crown that I read something like, Stephanie is a modern day mystic or contemporary mystic or something. And I, so I'm interested in talking with you about, like, what is animism to you? What is mysticism to you? Are those two words that you, I mean, it seems like animism is mystic a word that you use for yourself? How do you feel about that word?
That's funny. So the publisher of that book, Swarm Queen's Crown, is someone that I played D&D with.
Yes.
And we created, and I played it for the first time with him, and I always wanted to be mystic characters, like druids, and I always associated myself with those kind of magic users. And then when he put that on the back of the book, it felt like this strange, because it was something, I think I fictionalized the idea of what a mystic is, right? There's something, it's like lives in the imaginal realm.
Yeah.
I don't really associate with somebody who's like walking among us, or definitely not myself. But when he said that, and was like, own it, take it. It felt like I got to step into my D&D character, right? Like, it was this kind of ownership of it. And I feel like actually, and you probably feel the same, is like that step between when you're just a person writing things and then you call yourself a writer. It's that same kind of like, I am putting on this cloak, you know, and it's like a really mystical kind of feeling. Like it's like a rite of passage. And then for animism, that I remember that was a term I probably learned in like college or something. And it was one of those words that when I heard about it, it just lit something up. It's like this is the word I've been searching for, because it's something I feel I've just lived my whole life. And I was thinking, actually, on the car ride over, I was remembering, kind of laughing to myself, because there was this time that when my grandma first visited us here, she's from Guatemala, and there you don't have, like, there's not dish, like, her, she never had a dishwasher or anything like that. She had, like a sink with, I don't know what you call them, like serrated edges or something.
The ridges. Like a washboard.
And so she, when we had the washing machine always going, she felt sorrow for it and was like, she was like, that poor machine works all day. She was like, give it a break. And she, it's like she put personality and spirit to it. And, and that was very common, like, type of mentality I grew up around, was just that things have life, you know. And like in my mom grew up with this tradition, there are these two saints that have been in the family, like actual wooden figurines. They're actually two Christs, and they're, it's called the Black Christ of Esquipulas, and it comes from this one town. And there's this myth that I think the original one was brought from Spain or something, but after so many decades of people praying and like giving their suffering over to it, all the candle wax or the smoke turned it black. And so it's really interesting because it's a black Christ.
Yeah.
And the Mayans in that area really relate to it.
Yeah.
And I think partially it's like the skin color, but also just that idea that it's like suffused with suffering and mm-hmm. prayer and you know, all of that. But wow. So she had passed down, that they're probably like 200 years old, two of them, and they're treated like people. And all throughout my mom's life growing up, there's like a birthday for them, and it's like, I can't remember if it's January 11th or something like that, but at like 5 a.m. her and her siblings would have to get up like mm-hmm. in the dark and light candles. They would make hot chocolate and bedazzle these things with like, you know, like, I don't know, silver chains, and
yeah.
they have little like milagros nailed into them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one point where there's like, at some point somebody stole the gold milagro that was nailed on, you know, there's like all these
yeah.
histories. But I love the idea just with animism that these wooden figurines had life,
mm-hmm.
and they had a birthday, and they mm-hmm. had a day of celebration, and
yeah,
and that object. And I think that goes back to tarot, right? Because
mm-hmm.
it's like there's something very special about the cards being physical,
yeah,
and this idea that there could be knowledge or knowing in an object outside of ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and it allows us to kind of like shunt ourselves out of our own knowing and like let this otherness into the conversation.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. What do
yeah.
you think?
That's really interesting, because I feel like as you were speaking, like there were two ideas mm-hmm. that were happening in my head. And one was that, you know, like animism is usually this idea that everything innately has a sort of like spirit or life force.
Yeah.
Even if it is, you know, quote unquote inanimate, it
mm-hmm.
still has
yes.
this animate life, this animacy, this vitality to it. But then at the same time, when we, you know, work with tarot cards or bedazzle our saints or whatever
yeah.
the case
yeah.
may be, I feel like we're also putting our own meaning into them, or like enlivening
mm-hmm.
them, enlivening
mm-hmm.
them with
yeah.
our attention, with our love, with our sorrow.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And
it's beautiful. Like the way the saints suffused by the suffering,
yes.
by the wishes. Yeah.
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 And so I wonder if it is, you know, working both ways, that it's not
yes.
it's not just this like one way street of everything has like an innate animism and that's what it is, period, but a much more reflexive
yeah.
like participatory thing for all of us.
That feels very true. It's like it connects
mm-hmm.
it creates that connection between us and that connection of life
mm-hmm.
and even when you like, so I'm someone who doesn't believe in like strict reincarnation, like your whole spirit will reincarnate into this other whole spirit's body.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I have a very practical view of it, that literally everything is made of the same molecules
mm-hmm.
and they all just form each other in and out. And so
yeah.
there's constant reincarnation
yeah.
and it's messy and it's not like complete, you know, it's like there's part of you there, part of you here. There's a part of someone, a dinosaur, an idea even has expression in the body in cellular form, you know? So
yeah.
it's like, it feels like there's
yeah.
just an, yeah, like all of this energy in life is all around, and
mm-hmm.
animism is a way to give, I guess, to, it's like a, it gives voice to that kind of life that exists outside.
Mm-hmm.
But about science, I actually used to think I wanted, you know, it's like a common immigrant kid dream, and probably just many, many kids' dreams, to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I started going down that path, and I majored in biology
mm-hmm.
and was working in labs in college and in high school. And I remember in high school, I had like a lab internship, and I would purposefully come. Like once my lab mentor had trust in me, she let me stay like after everyone had left.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would purposefully come as late as possible so I could be alone there as late as possible.
Nice.
And I would just like mix things together. Like you'd open the fridge and it would be, and I didn't know much about some of the things. So I just remember in chemistry, we had just learned adenosine triphosphate is energy. You know, they like simplify things. And I opened the fridge and there are all these test tubes labeled like ATP. And I was like, pure energy and vital, you know, and I'm here like mixing. And I just loved all of the like apparatus. And I think that's what I really loved about science actually was not the logical part, but like the kind of mixing and looking under microscopes and the strangeness of it, like seeing DNA precipitate out of some like a clear liquid. Like it was, I loved all of that.
Well, wasn't science born in a mystical place? Like, I mean, alchemy was the original science.
Yeah.
And its pursuit wasn't, you know, to, I don't know, prove that God does not exist, which is somehow how we've decided science works now, you know, like, but was to like find the essence of life almost, you know?
And what's so cool about alchemy is that it was like the as above, so below of it all, you know, that what you're observing and what you're working on in the lab or in the materials is correlating to what is being refined in your own spirit, which I love. And then, of course, I think it was in high school too when I learned about like quantum, you know, like the idea of like the observer changes the observed and all of that. I was like, oh my God, like the alchemy and the science meeting in this really cool way.
Absolutely. That's where, because I've read your website, where you got the phrase, obscurum per obscurius.
Yeah.
Which means obscure through the more obscure, roughly.
Yeah.
Which I had to Google. And when I did, I discovered that, of course, it's usually seen as like a flaw if by explaining something obscure, you have to do it in a way that makes it even more obscure.
Right.
That's like a bad thing. But you're using it in this like magical, like positive, like almost like talismanic way, it seems. And I wanted to ask you about that. So like what, when we are engaging with something obscure, why, like what do, like tell me about that. What's the mystery of, or magic or whatever of going through
Yes, I love that phrase. And actually, it reminds me of like when you look at alchemical texts or something, there's always like these crazy levels of initiation and mystery. And I love this idea that, and I know it's used in this kind of like bad way of criticizing, like making something even more complex than it needs to be. Mm-hmm. But what I like it in the mystical context of that something that lives in mystery, you can only approach through mystery. Mm-hmm. And if by somehow take like stripping away the mystery, you actually lose the essence of that thing. So that's my own strange way that I digested it. And
I mean that, so I'm whenever I look up a word, I hate it when they define the word just like with its own word. Like when you look up like obscurity and it's like the property of being obscure or something. I'm like, this is this is not helpful. But I love when I look up a word and it is defined with other words that I also have to look up. You know,
it takes you on a journey of discovery. That's exactly
And like I think that there's so much emphasis in our modern world of like rendering things legible, like rendering things like understandable, quantifiable, succinctly defined. And we've lost so much, lost so much like knowledge, experience, true sort of understanding in the process of that.
That's a huge thing. And I think a lot about like, you know, TV, which is such a huge global medium that affects so much, you know, in so many ways. And at least in Hollywood, like that, the need to make everything legible is such a part of that system. You know, like things have to be explained to executives who have to take it to their boss and explain it to them who explain it to a financier, you know? So it's like, there's the, there are so many levels of squashing and And it's always a miracle to me when something brilliant gets through,
yeah.
because that there's so much miracle that had to go into like that perfect configuration.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is an excellent segue to talk about your screenwriting, because Stephanie is a multi-talented person, and you've written, you've been a writer and a story editor. On mm-hmm. Two Sentence Horror Stories.
Yeah.
Which is CW and also on Netflix.
Yeah.
And...
Right. So that show was created by my friend Vera Miao, mm-hmm. and she's a really creative, strange person who has a really incredibly, you know, strange imagination. So it's really interesting. Like, she created this platform to create, tell short horror stories, mm-hmm. But that also got filtered through the CW's, development process. And so that was a really interesting process because I learned very quickly, like, how hard it is to get ideas through. Mm-hmm. And so even though it was a lot of fun and there's so much to learn there, and it was also really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. To kind of... It feels like you're like wrestling like a greased snake or something and trying to hold on to what's yours, you know?
Yeah.
And that's actually, you know, with tarot, it's interesting because I will read in exchange for money. Like, it mm-hmm. is something that can have a professional part mm-hmm. to it. But I also read, like, I have a really interesting relationship to that. And I think it's probably different for people who read and that's their sole source of income. Mm-hmm. But for me, because it's not, I've felt this freedom and like I can offer this to anyone who needs it. Or like yeah. if somebody is, you know, like the exchange can happen in many ways. It doesn't have to be monetary.
Yeah.
It can be because it's an exchange of healing energies. Like there's always like some kind of healing yeah. involved in that work, even if they want to talk about, you know, sometimes people come and they're like, I just want, they have the most mundane seeming questions, like, am I going to get this job? Mm-hmm. But really, I think always underneath is some kind of deeper wound.
Yeah.
hidden maybe even in the really practical questions that people have. And
yeah.
so it's always a kind of healing work.
Yeah. They come in just wanting like a yes, no answer. Mm-hmm. And you're like, let's talk about your trauma. Yeah. I mean, I feel that as far as tarot in exchange for money. Like, of course, I do think that,
yeah.
you know, it is labor. Like, it's a...
It is, yeah.
You know, and so people should be paid for it. But I haven't actually been doing client readings in like 2 years now, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I've still, like, I've read for friends and stuff like
right.
that, but it's like I stopped during the pandemic because it just got to be
mm-hmm.
it was too much. I wasn't able to, like, I was a mess. And I don't think that you have to be like together in order
yeah.
to be an effective tarot reader,
right.
but like I started feeling this sense of urgency from people,
mm-hmm.
like almost like they were wanting something like very specific from me, and I wasn't mm-hmm. able to give that
like
to
a
them.
Certainty,
yeah,
a reassurance that everything that there won't be a forest fire tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, and the times when I read that I actually really enjoyed the most were times when I was like a few times when I was hired by like a corporate entity
mm-hmm.
to read for their
mm-hmm.
holiday party,
mm-hmm.
but that meant that everybody who sat down at my table, none of them were giving me money. They were just sitting down for
yeah.
the experience,
right.
you know, as
yeah.
like a laugh or like, you know,
yeah.
and something about that felt so good. Just having people come to the table, not like with any sense of desperation or,
yeah.
but just with this openness to the experience.
Like
basically.
A little curiosity, maybe nerves. I know
yes.
exactly what you're talking
yes.
about. Like the events were that, and sometimes those people who are kind of like, okay, I'll do that. You know, it's like they're like kind of putting up walls, and then
mm-hmm.
they're often the ones who are like,
mm-hmm.
get really quiet and are like,
mm-hmm.
you know, cover their mouth and they're just like taking it all in, and that's...
Yep, precisely.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about when you make art, it feels like it's coming in from somewhere else, whether it's physical art, the tarot cards that you're making, or whether it's poetry. Is that similar to the act of reading the cards, or is that different?
It's similar in some ways. Like, I think there's like an unlatching that lets the unconscious through. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, you know, it's like when I can feel myself when I'm more closed, because then I'm more using my mind, my mm-hmm. brain, to be like, oh, I know this card, you know, I know the symbols of this card, I know mm-hmm. the archetypes of this card. And sometimes I'll, you know, if I'm not tapped in and I'm in a reading, I almost have to like start it here in my mind, and then as it opens, I go back and I'm like, okay, now that we're open, I can actually, you know, and the person is giving you energy too. Like, everything is speaking in that moment.
Yeah.
The silence, what people are saying or not saying. And that to me is all very important. Like, it all comes together. And then the narrative of the cards themselves, like, they all, you have to, like, you know, they all start to speak together.
Yeah.
And so it's reiterative. And I think that's common to every process I have, is there's this kind of building and gradual opening. And then it deepens and deepens as it goes. And then it kind of coalesces into something by the end.
Yeah.
And there's always nerves at the beginning, because you never see it all.
Yeah.
You know, and that's true of any artwork. It's like there's always the nerves of, like, where is this going? What does this look like? What's it going to be? And the nerves of not knowing mm-hmm. something. And mm-hmm. then and then there's that like joy when you're like, oh, I don't have to know it. The knowing comes. And for some reason that happens every time. It's like, you know it and then you forget it. And
it sounds like almost like you look at the cards and they are obscure.
Yeah.
And then you have to enter the obscurity and just walk through that space of unknowing in order to.
Yeah. Exactly.
Discover.
Totally obscurum, para obscurius. And it's always something when I know when it's unlocked, because it'll be something that I didn't notice in the card before. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because even like the Ansata deck, which it was my first deck that I got when I was like 16, I think. I've looked at it for all of these decades and I'll see something I never noticed before, you know, like, especially in that card. That card's like, has like Hieronymus Bosch type, like little critters in the margins and little like details, but I'll see something I never noticed. And then that's like, comes in full. It has nothing to do with the archetype of the card. Mm-hmm. It's this like noticing that is actually, kind of cracking open your knowing.
Yeah.
And that's when I feel tapped in.
Yeah.
But I have to start with what I know. It's like, I don't get to just, I wish I could just start without that, you know, but
yeah,
it's like I have to dream my way into it.
I love that. I love that. I've always thought that tarot for me is an act of both knowing and unknowing.
Yeah.
And it's for me both, like, you know, intuitive, mystical, obscure, and at the same time, there is like a cerebral or analytical aspect to it in the making of the meaning.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. All those parts come to play.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so true. Especially in the end, I think once it's all kind of presented itself. And usually, I don't know if you find the same thing. It's like everything that's has to be said has been said. Mm-hmm. And there's like a moment of silence. Mm-hmm. And then it's like that analytical part steps up. And it's like, and now I'm going to wrap this up in some way. Or it's like it presents this kind of like overview. And sometimes it's not a summary per se, but maybe just like this thing lifts from the reading that has this like different aspect of clarity.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Or like a synthesis or something that arises.
Then that makes me think of alchemy too, because there's so much about alchemy that is like things coagulating, things coming apart, then like another substance arising from that, and then that being taken apart. You know, it's like there's this all continual coming together and taking apart, and then a further essence being drawn from that or distilled from that.
Yeah.
And it's all of that.
Yeah. So we were talking about dreams a little bit, or like, you know, relating the space of like reading tarot and also art creation, poetry creation, all of this to, you know, in some ways to this dream space. And of course, like, it's not always like a sleeping dream space. So when we talk about like this sort of, I guess my question is twofold. So I'm curious about what that means to you. What is like this dream space or dream knowing to you? And then I want to talk about your poetry book. Because that's very much
the title. Dream space. Like, I feel like the whole body is a dream space, you know, and that we're, let's see, what's the right way to say it? I guess I feel like the imagination is constant in all of ourselves, you know, like when you think of actual dreaming at night, and the fact that that arises from the body, and it's just the things held in the body, and you see all the layers and the mixings and matchings and the kind of asynchronicities and the way that when you're awake you can be like, it was a man, but it was also a girl, and it was also a bird, you know, it's like, but somehow in the dream there was no conflict there. And I think because our whole body is creative, and our whole and it's holding all experience, all memories we don't even have memory of. It's holding ancestry, and it's alive. It's not just static library, you know, and they're continuing to live and be. And so to me, like, that anytime we tap into imagination, we're also connecting to that dream space of the body. And so that I think that happens in tarot, right? When you're reading, it's like you are kind of letting that stuff speak, and letting what's inside come forth, and letting the outside, you know, and we're all permeable too. So it's like what we were talking about with animism is that interplay is happening. But I feel that's why I've always been really drawn to surrealism, because it feels like it honors that kind of like really like dreamy, mythic inner world, and makes it really visible. And and, you know, we didn't even talk about like fantasy and stuff, which I know we both love, but the fact that, you know, in fantasy films and books and stuff, I think it's just so rewarding to see actual worlds that we kind of feel and intuit inside of ourselves, or in the invisible realms.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it makes me think of that word mysticism again, and like some of the things that we've talked about and that you've said. Like, I think at the beginning you said something about like not being a good thinker, but I think that being a good thinker is so often what cuts us off from being able to access these other spaces. And like the same thing when we were talking about like obscurity and legibility and all of that, like the brain, the mind, being able to think clearly and rationally, all wonderful, necessary things. But when we just hammer those to the exclusion of everything else, when we say the only things that are true are the things that we can empirically see or measure, or that's just so, I mean,
so
in a way,
limiting.
Yeah, and also even like unscientific as well, because science has even proven, again, it's proven itself wrong so many times.
Yeah, it's like this tiny little light constantly trying to say that everything is only the what fits in the little, you know, circle of its light is what can be real, and that's so not true. I think it's something I've always struggled with, like this idea of desiring, probably a very made up illusion of what it means to think clearly. And I think that's an interesting thing, because I think in the tarot speaks a lot about clarity. There's a lot of cards that teach us about that. And you know, when you think of the swords, I think there's an archetype of clarity that's really clear cut, you know, and it's really lifted above everything else, and it's something you can be guided by unerringly. But then I think there's more like arcane ways to think of clarity, and I've been thinking about clarity a lot in terms of, you know, taking it out of the mind space, and what does it mean to have, you know, clarity in the body that might actually feel very swampy and still have find one certainty in that kind of like embodied swampy dream space. Like, that has been kind of calling my attention lately.
That made me think of the centipede again, because of exoskeletons.
Yeah.
Like, and I guess in the swampiness on the inside, like this, I don't actually know about like what's on the inside of a centipede.
Mysteries.
mysteries.
Just so many mysteries.
But that's kind of like what it feels like almost like, I don't know. And even that exoskeleton, it is porous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like osmosis. And, well, I mean, I don't think that like centipedes sweat, but like we certainly sweat.
Yeah, totally.
The boundaries or the shells that we like to put around things.
Yeah.
Aren't even like hermetically sealed, like, yeah,
right,
you know.
Right. And centipedes too, I feel like they're kind of reviled, you know, and there's something so other about them that it creates this like feeling of fear, and I'm really interested in that too, you know, and like what does it mean to like really allow that in.
Yes.
And that, and knowing too, and in myself, I feel like I'm always drawn to the things that make me really uncomfortable in myself.
Is this why you like horror?
Probably. I love to body horror, and I love things that draw our attention back to the like real primal existence of the body. And you know, horror is always showing us what's inside. Like, it's always showing the blood and like what happened, like that the body is actually, because so much in our society is built around, you know, like the ideas of false safety, and that I think horror is constantly showing us the real peril and the real struggle, and I think we all live with that.
Yeah.
Even like anxiety, even like in this scientifically, you know, proven that like anxiety is a survival mechanism that comes from past experiences of our like animal ancestors' trauma. And so like we carry danger in us at all times. And I just,
One thing that I wanted to say about horror also is that I really appreciate, well, and just, it doesn't have to be hard, just anything period, when things are complicated, when it's not just a here's good and here's evil, but it's actually much more entangled and complicated than that, such as in the Elliot episode. There were like, I loved that episode.
Oh, thank you.
And I thought that it was really well done, showing, you know, a trans character who's being bullied at school.
Yeah.
But, like, also not just doing this, like, one person is completely right, one person is completely... I mean, the bullies are wrong, but... Right. So I should say one person is, like, the completely good and pure... hero.
Yeah.
And...
letting them have their own
forces.
Journey into darkness a little bit. And because I think a lot of... things push us that in that direction, and I had spoken with a friend who was like, you know, who's trans and who had been attacked once, and was like, I attacked back and actually really hurt the other person. I was like, but I'm not somebody who hurts people, but I had to do that, you know. And actually Elliot is based a lot on my partner's experiences being bullied, and it was that's always a hard one, you know, because I think that was actually a hard episode for me too, because there's a fine line between the things we're trying to show or teach, and then at what point does that turn around and also become harmful. Mm-hmm. But because the CW has such a huge global reach, I was like, actually, this could, there's a lot of people who haven't seen this before and need to. And there's so much with like legislation around bathrooms mm-hmm. and stuff. It just was very important at that time. But yeah, but so much of it was, you know, from my partner's, you know, past, and just thinking about those things that live in you. But also I love a good revenge moment. So like, yeah. I think they even cut it down, but like when Elliot gets the principal's hand and like mangles it, mm-hmm. that was so satisfying. Just the like the body horror that they
ear to I'm
like,
ear.
Hee, hee, hee. Yeah. Yes. And I remember the network was like, ooh, that's, you know, that's too much. Like Elliot, people are going to now like not be on Elliot's side. And I was like, oh no, like people are going to be on Elliot's side.
Literally like, cheering.
Like, people want more, actually. Like, let's just, like, twist his whole body up. But no, they didn't want to.
I think that that's... I mean, yeah. I think that it's so important to show... to have complicated characters. Trans characters who get to be complicated. Who don't have to be, like, perfect.
Angels, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like... I love a good, like, you know, queer villain. I mean, not back when, you know, I love all Disney villains, but that's because I see villains. Myself in the, and there's a part of me that loves wickedness.
I do too. And I think in a lot of horror movies, like the monster is the hero. Mm-hmm. I actually don't mm-hmm. care a lot of the times about the people who are being attacked. Like, I'm not here like hoping the monster gets killed. I'm always like a little sad when or you're like happy when, like, you know, Michael Myers disappears, because you're like, mm-hmm. haha, he'll be back. But I love the villains.
The first time that I'm just going to be a literature nerd here for a second. The first time I read Beowulf in probably high school, I was like, this story is awful.
Yeah.
Why are they going after these, like, poor creatures?
Yeah, exactly.
Why do they have to go bother this, like, mom
like
monster?
Alone.
Yeah. Like, what did she do to you? You
just
know?
Leave her be. I know. That was actually a bait into Sense Sorcerer. I mean, there was so many stories that didn't make the cut or got thrown out, or ideas, you know, like dozens and dozens and dozens. But one of them was going to have, like, two... like, there were these two women who had this, like, wicked love game.
Yes.
That, you know, where you think they're... you think they're being... I can't remember what the story was, but that basically the twist was that they were kind of villains, uh-huh. like wicked villains. Uh-huh. And it was going to be really fun and B-movie and just mm-hmm. kind of like a play on their, you know, attack on like hetero life.
Yes.
And the network was like, absolutely not. And they were trying to do it from a really like no, we cannot have queer villains, like we can't. And I was like, you know, it was just like such a heart, and there was no passing that through.
no but we do, like, I don't know, we'll move past this stage eventually. Realize that, like, you know, queer people can be flawed and still deserve rights. You know, like, the queer villains deserve as many rights as the straight villains do.
They do. Yeah. I'm actually writing a story. I don't know when I'll finish, but it's a feature film that I've just been writing for myself. And the main character is this kind of outsider girl. And she, mm-hmm. I sort of based her on my mom and set it in the time of her childhood, like in the 60s in Guatemala. And she actually is queer. My mom is not, but this character is. Mm-hmm. It's like a blend of me and her. But she becomes a literal monster in the story. And, like, that's her path of becoming. Mm-hmm. And just, like, you know, it's also, like, an eco-tale. So it's, like, she kind of represents the Earth's, mm-hmm. you know, vengeance.
Oh.
But
yes,
it's been so satisfying to, like, write towards that and just...
the Earth is queer.
The earth is so, the so earth is queer. Incredibly queer.
And incredibly monstrous.
Yeah. Yeah, truly.
That's Frankenstein, I feel like, I mean, when I, like Beowulf, when I first read that, I was like on the Frankenstein's monster's side. I was on the side of the creature. Yeah. And then, you know, when I discovered as an adult what Susan Stryker did with reframing the Frankenstein story as a trans story and like embracing the monstrosity of like being trans, being other, the body aspect of you know, those of us who get surgery or take HRT and like embrace. I wish that I have it on the shelf, but I can't climb over all of my equipment to go get it. There's a line in it that says something like, so Susan Stryker is performing it as the creature from Frankenstein, and she says something like, I am like as natural and as monstrous as you, like we are all created, you know, like that. Your idea of nature is a lie. Yeah. Like it's,
oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. I remember taking in college a class from Joan Roughgarden, who was, probably still is, a trans professor at Stanford, and she taught a class, what was it called? Gender Diversity in Nature, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it totally blew my mind, you know, like just, I think her, one of the things she studied was birds, you know, but we looked at all kinds of things, just like, so many genders, so much transformation, and just all of it. And it was amazing. It was so such a beautiful class. Yeah. And just seeing like the hyena that that like becomes the like takes the dominant male role, the, you know, just all of these things. And she took it beyond all of that too, you know, and just, the whole class felt like poetry. Mm-hmm. And weirdly, one of the things I remember most about that class was this idea that birds are always watching us. And she said, you know, she was like, you know, nature sees you much more than you see it. And that like really came in deep.
Yeah.
You know? And this idea, and you think of how much like mimicry there is in nature too, and like something sees something and it can take on that form, like when you think of like a stick insect or these insects or like butterflies that look like owl eyes, and it's like how does the seeing happen, you know? And I think of queerness in that way too. It's just like bodies are, you know, everything's much queerer than we even have words for.
Oh, absolutely. And ways of knowing, ways of seeing, ways of cognition are much stranger.
Ways of loving and ways of, knowing, and what even knowing, sometimes knowing means like taking in and embodying and becoming and like all of that, like that level of queerness too, of like what even attraction can mean, or like beyond mating or sexual preference or excitement, but like just all of these ways that things interact and interweave and reflect each other and oppose each other. Like it was,
Yeah. Did you see the thing recently that they like discovered that plants scream?
Oh like, God!
Like when you cut grass. Like,
oh God!
I was like, oh no! I knew it, but like, oh.
Yeah, there's so much sentient. I mean, it's like so. Yeah, it's intense, like all of the feeling. I always think, what was that book, Snowpiercer? It was a comic book, and then they made a show or movie out of it. But the comic, it's in the future, and like some disasters happened, and all of what's left of humanity is on a train, one train. It's like, you know, the poor are in the back and the privileged are in the front, and it's this battle for equality. But in one of the train carts, it's like the meat cart or something, and they've synthesized meat, but it's like living. And so when they, it's just like a vat of cellular meat, but when they touch it, it shivers. And like that has stuck with me so much, but I think a lot about just like what are the things that are feeling out there that we don't know.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like Soylent Green to the next.
Yeah. It's like Soylent Green with eyes.
Yeah. Oh man.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, before we get too in the weeds about about meat replacements.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your book of poetry that's coming out.
Yes.
By the time this episode airs, it will probably be already out.
It comes out May 2nd.
So tell us about it. So it's Dream of Shibalba.
A Dream of Shibalba. It's actually it's one long poem in untitled fragments. And I think I started writing this, it's so hard to say because something, you know, things come from all over the place and I forget, but after my grandma died in 2018, my mom's mom, who holds a lot of, for me, it's like, I don't know if you have anyone in your family like this, but they hold a lot of your lineage and sense of like identity in that sense. And she is of an indigenous background, and had still a lot of like the Mayan practices. Like she would grind the corn on her stone and just things that I grew up around that I felt like I could feel lineage in her presence, and in her way of speaking. Like she never learned to read or write. And so she had this really like the way she told stories and stuff is like, I feel like an extinct art because it came from like a totally oral tradition. And even her understanding of the Bible as just this sacred object that you hold, and like she couldn't read it, she would even be holding it upside down sometimes, and it's just like the sense that there could be like a text that holds things. And she didn't, it's like she had this kind of beautifully naive version of Catholicism that was all intermixed with like indigenous practices and stuff. But so a lot of it came from just fragments that started arising from that time. And it was also when I moved from Portland to LA and to kind of explore screenwriting, and it felt like this really kind of scary thing of like, I left my job, my partner and my dogs couldn't come with me, and so I was like all alone there. And it was this kind of, and there were like sirens every night. I kind of felt like when I was living in New York, there's this like helicopters all around, and like there'd be like screaming at night, and like Trump and just like disasters and like climate. It was so much happening, and it was like all of the like memories of the past, stories of the past were blending with moments in the present, and this kind of question of like, how do we become what we are started coming into this. And it takes kind of the shit, like Shibalba is the Mayan underworld, and I was thinking about underworld journeys and how it's just something that we do every day. You know what I mean? We do it when we dream, we go down and we come up, and we're constantly being broken, and we constantly have to put ourselves back together again. And I think what happened too was just letting myself kind of claim these fragments that weren't whole. Especially when somebody dies, you can't go back and say, what was the story again, what, you know, who was this, or like, tell me more about that. It's like, oh, all I have are the fragments. And so this became a place for those fragments to live. And actually, before I knew the structure, I just had these lines and fragments, and titles didn't feel right for them, so they were all untitled. And then I realized it was, this is all one poem. This is like one piece that's not really whole or complete. It's not like I begin and I wrap it up with a bow, like a reading. It's actually kind of just ends and it's ongoing. And that's what it is.
I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
I wanted to say for the people at home that just everything you do feels like it has pieces of everything else you do in it. Mm-hmm. So, like, in a beautiful way. And so the cover art for this is illustrated by the person who created the Tarot del Fuego deck.
Yeah, Ricardo Cabolo, who's a Spanish artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he did an amazing job. And there was actually a piece of artwork I showed him. I'm trying to remember his name. He was like an artist who did sci-fi covers. Huh. Carol Toll, I think, was his name. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but he did this beautiful image of like a giantess, like a woman who was asleep in a pool. Mm. And you can see like tiny little cityscapes by her head just to get a sense of her shape. And I just love the idea of this like huge dreaming woman. But in my vision, she's sleeping in a pool of blood.
Naturally.
And so I gave, you know, when Ricardo asked about what cover art, I showed him that image. And then I said I wanted a vulture. And I showed him an image from the Mayan ruins that are 10 minutes from my grandmother's house at Zapuleu, where I used to play when I was little. And he put one of, like, he actually was, just from reading a few of the poems, intuited to like make it all ruined. Like there's like things floating in the blood. There's like fire and like fragments of stone and bone and like a bat, you know, and I just love that he, you know, that's his skill as an artist, which is to kind of like intuitively pull out those things. And then on the back, the quetzal, which is like a symbol in the book, but it's the bird of Guatemala, and it's in so much of the lore, and it has, you know, sometimes the tail is seen as like two serpents. And I just love that this idea of like a bird and a snake together. And it's bright red and bright green, which I also love subverting, like taking back the quote unquote Christmas colors and letting them be like of the jungle again.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, will you read something from it? We talked about doing it maybe bibliomancy style.
Yeah, should we? Let's do it that
style.
Sound
good? So bibliomancy, for anybody who isn't aware, is the practice of like taking a book, a text, and flipping through it and then saying stop at some point, or intuitively stopping at some point, right? And then...
Well, Charlie, would you want to like ask a question? Like maybe what we could do is you could ask something open-ended, and then we can see what the book says, and then I can just read from that point on or something for a little bit.
Okay. Feels, trying not to feel like there's pressure on this.
No pressure. It can be the easiest question ever. It could even be like not a question, but just like, tell me something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I want a message for dreaming.
Ooh, a message for dreaming. Okay, so you'll tell me when to stop.
Okay. Stop.
Okay, and then tell me again.
Stop.
You wonder, when will the hurled stone break the edge of your heaven? So, message for dreaming. I think there's some kind of break, busting open that could happen there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You wonder, when will the hurled stone
finally break the edge of your heaven?
I love, and I don't know what the context of that passage is. But just those words, the finally part of it has a sense of like necessity it.
Yeah.
And the breaking and the edge makes me think of everything that we've been talking about as far as like
the knowing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The containers that we feel have to be there but don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the stone is something usually feared in this context when it's hurled.
Yeah.
But welcoming that instead, perhaps.
It makes me think about, because, you know, it's like heaven is this container that's always so separate and removed and something we can't really access. And maybe in dreaming, maybe what it's inviting is that, like, let your dreaming spill into awakeness. Ooh, I like that.
The listeners can't see me, but I'm like, my head is spinning around like Beetlejuice right now.
Let your heaven be now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll just read from that page beyond that. That's, we're kind of smack in the middle of the book. The book is divided, so it's all one poem, but it's divided in two chapters. Mm-hmm. And that landed us in the middle of right at the end of chapter 6, out of 12. So I'll just read like two or three.
Please
do. Does that sound good? Okay.
Please do.
At dinner, you find a slick gray stone floating in your soup, the heart of a hen, en el caldo un espejo. You turn, not wanting to see, a woman in white who crosses the courtyard, hollow-eyed, mumbling her ballad of the machete. Mi marido que me quitó las manos, mi marido que quitó la cabeza. Her body trails behind her in the shape of a dog. Flesh rings like a telephone, traveling body to body on the night's cord. Hurt comes spilling through the open line. Each voice falls braided to the bottom of the well, thick and black as a horse's tail. You live there, under the weight of old water. You live there. In the tunnels beneath Zakuleu, you put on the sleep of a mongrel, a secret perfume touched to the fold of each eye. Out into the day, under the sun, you wear the dog's glistening tears. Mm. Actually, that comes from like a superstition that I grew up with, that if you, I don't know why this would have been a thing, but if you touch like the sleep that forms around a dog's eyes and then touch your own eyes, you'll see ghosts.
Ooh.
And so my grandma and stuff would always tell us, like, don't, you know, if you're playing with dogs, you know, wash your hands or be careful. Don't, like, touch their eyes and touch your eyes because mm-hmm. you'll start to see what they see. Huh. And, you know, how dogs always will, like, bark at nothing or, you know, there's this sense, at least with my grandmother and, like, where she grew up, that dogs are privy to, like, the other realms and mm-hmm. they can just clearly see what we can't.
If I was a kid, I would have been like,
oh, yeah,
rubbing some dog sleep in my eyes.
Totally. I was like, I want to see the ghost. And I love, you know, and this one's like in the tunnels beneath Zakuleo. So in Zakuleo, which was a 10-minute walk from her house, there was, it's been blocked off now, but there was a time when there was like a tunnel under one of the temples that you could crawl into, and it was like really narrow. And we would always play in that tunnel. And there's actually a superstition that there's like an actual deep tunnel somewhere under the ruins that like leads to like, you know, the mountain or some other, you know, some like really distant place, or it leads to another group of ruins. Mm-hmm. And we always would pretend that was the tunnel, the one that we were playing in. It was just goes through one of the temples, but you know, there would be a point where it was too narrow to keep going. And we would just, it was like the imagination of not knowing where it leads, and just you could play into that, yeah. like where it goes. And
yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of memories, like this book has so many like actual memories that are kind of like pulled out and then rewoven. Like the first fragment I read talks about the finding like the heart, like the chicken heart in the soup. Mm-hmm. And I remember that so clearly. You know, the first time there was a chicken heart in my soup. And, you know, in my grandma's house in Guatemala, it's like the chickens were outside, and then next thing you're like eating them, you know. And mm-hmm. I remember very clearly that moment of recognition happening right there, because I don't think I knew for a while that was the chain of events.
Yeah.
And then I was like, the heart made it very, because, you know, meat gets abstracted.
Yeah.
But the heart was undeniably a heart.
Yeah.
Even when it was all gray and cooked. And so that kind of floated into that poem, you know, and this idea of like death and existing, you know, this kind of co-mixing with animals. And yeah,
and something as like mundane and comforting as a bowl of soup.
Yes.
having, you know, both death and nurturance.
Yeah.
Like sustenance.
Yeah, in it. Totally. And then weirdly, later in that fragment, and that's another example of like how it just kind of has that dream logic, but like after the soup, then there's this like the ghost is visible, you know.
The way that you wrote the ghost's eyes made me think of the stone in the soup.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Ooh. Like, I don't know if that was intentional or why, but like something about the way you described them, I saw.
I love that.
That other image.
No, not intentional, but I just absolutely love that connection. There's something really interesting I liked about this idea that, you know, we're often searching for wholeness, mm-hmm. and healing. That's, you know, the common thing that everyone wants. And I think this book made me really think about what wholeness means. Yeah. And this idea of, like, you know, that we can create a wholeness from the pieces and from all the, you know, fragments.
Yeah.
And or not, you know, and let it be unwhole, and that can, you know, held in the right container, that can have its own kind of wholeness, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. That feels like, I think that feels like an excellent place to wrap this up. Mm.
This, yeah. So I feel like we could go on so many tangents forever and ever.
It has been an act of self-control, yeah. on my part to like try to do any semblance of steering this conversation.
Yeah, I know. I feel like, yeah, there's so many things. I was like, oh, I want to follow that trail, uh-huh. so badly.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, for doing this with me.
This was the best. Thank you, Charlie.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's BIRDGERHL_, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.